You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And welcome into a Thursday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. You are listening to Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm your host, Gavin Shaw. I traveled from the deserts of Phoenix, Arizona. It's desolate out there. There's maybe one building over five stories. I was in that one building covering the Phoenix Suns. And then I came back to my native New York City to talk to you guys about the Brooklyn Nets on a full-time basis. And I'm joined by the, hates this moniker, the lifelong fan, Josh Bass. Josh, I did back-to-back pods on the past three games that you were absent from because I decided to do them in the middle of the night. But I wanted to give you a chance to just share any random thoughts you had. That was the Pacers, Wizards, and Kings matchups. Just go in wherever you see fit.
Yeah, well, Gavin, I'm sorry for leaving you alone for those podcasts, but I heard you did an admirable job. I personally don't listen to any episodes.
Yeah, but, I'm aware.
But my sources are telling me that you did well.
Yeah, you click play on all of them, and that's really all we ask of
no,
all
I
of our audience.
Download, I don't play.
Anything. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, as long as you download, like to get the numbers, Josh, I think you have to hit play. So you're not even really you're doing like a half measure, but you're doing like a 20% measure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No,
anyway,
the
conclusion is we're all about the numbers. We don't really need anything other than that. All right, now that we got that out of the way, did you have any thoughts on those games, or should we get into the Spurs and Pelicans?
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple of thoughts on, I think there were a couple close games, obviously, against the Raptors, or not, was it Raptors game close? No, it wasn't close. Mixing up my game.
Kings.
Pacers game. Yeah, Pacers King, game was yes, very sir. Close. Kings, we had a shot. Wizards, you know, listen, I think people are getting... The Wizards game is great, obviously. We love that. I think people are getting on Dinwiddie too much for shooting three-pointers at the end of close games. But at the same time, I can't blame him for that because we're still getting a look. And there was a game maybe a week or two ago, where Dinwiddie missed the three ball. The ball went off the other team. I forget who it was. It might have been the Pacers game. You should correct me on this, Gavin. And then the Nets couldn't inbound it and had a five-second violation.
I think it was the Kings game.
Yeah, so the Kings game. That happens all the time. Like, when you're the Nets and you don't have any stud shot creators, you just have to take the first decent look you can get, and you know that Dinwiddie can always get that three-pointer off, and even though it hasn't been going in lately, it's still a decent look in the aggregate. So even though he's missing, you have to think of the alternatives. And with the Nets offense, with a motion-heavy offense, it's not easy for them to get a shot off instantaneously, and that's why they get a lot of 24-second violations, because they have trouble creating. So, guys, give Dinwiddie a break for taking those shots at the end of games. They're going to start to fall if he keeps taking them, and they're decent looks, and there's no real great alternative option at this point.
Yeah, no,
I feel about that.
I tend to agree with you. I'd kind of be interested to see Caris LeVert have the ball in his hands more in those situations, just because he has been shooting it so well, and he does seem like a legitimate threat going to the rim, driving, and he's kind of figured out his timing on those passes. But yeah, ultimately, out of the guys the Nets have available right now, Dinwiddie is the one I ultimately want to have the ball in his hands. And we talk about his shooting being off, but then against the Wizards, like he basically ended the game at the beginning of the third quarter by coming out and hitting those three consecutive three balls. And then against Indiana, he had that brilliant play at the end where he just I can't remember who was closing out on him. It might have been – I don't think it was Oladipo. It might have been Darren. It was someone was closing out on him. And he just saw the hands were up and they were down three, and he just goes right up into the guy's hands and draws a foul. And like when the defender – It was Kojo. And the defender just like didn't expect him to shoot it at all. And he just makes smart, smart plays in those situations. To your point though, and like I don't – this is like – We're kind of robbing the end of the show of like a big talking point, because this was like a big issue I had in the Pelicans game. Just all the shot clock violations and all the issues with that. I think to your point, that stuff is kind of inevitable. Like, I mean, not just because of the type of offense they run, but because without D'Angelo Russell and Jeremy Lin, they're really bereft of guys who can consistently create their own shot. Like you see LeVert and Dinwiddie doing it in spurts, but Dinwiddie isn't really explosive enough to do that consistently, and LeVert might be able to in a couple of years, but he's just too young, too inexperienced, doesn't really quite have the pacing down to just break guys down time after time after time. So that's really a tough ask, and that guy just, again, without Russell, like Russell is that guy, but without Russell, that guy just doesn't really exist in the Nets rotation right now.
Mm-hmm. And listen, for me, Gavin, what's the most deflating thing that can happen when your team has a chance to tie the game or take the lead, and they don't even get a shot off and it's a turnover to end the game? That is so demoralizing. So when you have a player like Spencer Dinwiddie, I agree that LeVert might be more dynamic, and I think he is, and he's been absolutely sensational in December, and that's props to him for figuring out his shot and also being more aggressive. But Dinwiddie has the lowest turnover rate, I think, in the league, or almost in the league, especially on the Nets. So he can get a shot off, and you have to take what you can get, and especially with this Nets team where they're faltering, just being in the games is nice to see, and being able to get a decent look off and really scare teams. The wins are going to come if they keep this up. They're not going to be a playoff team this year. They're not going to be a 35-win team, but they're going to, even though they're faltering lately, they're going to win some games to close the year if they keep playing hard.
Yeah, and I'll throw this out there, and this was, again, an issue against the Pelicans, because the energy just has to be there on a night-to-night basis, because in those situations where a shot clock is winding down or you're in crunch time and you're going against the set half-court defense, it can't be all on Dinwiddie or, as we said, sometimes LeVert to create against a defense totally focused on them. Like, even in the Pacers game, even though they were really good in crunch time, on like one of the biggest plays of the game when they were still down by five, it was like a minute left, Dinwiddie was driving baseline and no one really cut off his drive to give him much of a chance. Like, obviously those guys were spacing, but someone has to come and help him out with the ball. And what Dinwiddie ended up doing was he created the passing lane that wasn't there for himself just by making a brilliant play. He looked off Damari Carroll's defender in the corner. The guy takes a step towards Joe Harris. Dinwiddie throws a no-look to Carroll, and Carroll hits a three. That's a great play, but it's just because Dinwiddie was really, really smart and executed really, really well. But more often than not, that's not a play that can happen without help. So they have to kind of figure out how to play with that energy, possession in and possession out, because if not, you are going to inevitably end up with a lot of shot clock violations when you don't have the one-on-one guys that are just going to carry you on a night-to-night basis.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, and that's kind of more of an existential piece of this next team that we can kind of get into as we move farther along the season. And obviously, that's going to change once D'Angelo Russell comes back. But let's get into some of these games from the last couple of days. And from the San Antonio Spurs game, I can't even not laugh when I'm saying this, but Quincy Acey's performance, just jacking up threes. I think he took 10 threes in 20 minutes. Just no shame. It was absolutely ridiculous and kind of spectacular to watch at the same time. What was your take on AC's performance?
All right. Well, I just want to throw out there the qualifier, because I want to be honest with everyone. My DVR conked out, so I only got to watch like the first quarter and a half of this game. But Josh, I did. Yeah. I did send you a text saying what I think happened with AC, because, you know, when you're playing the Spurs, they tend to Spursgasm all over teams like the Nets and just blow them out of the water. And so I think what Kenny Atkinson wanted to do was create variance by popping up a bunch of three-pointers. The Nets shot 32 on the night and hit a respectable 12 for 37.5%. So I had just imagined the entire game, AC, who went 3 for 12 in 20 minutes, 2 for 10 from 3. He's been shooting a little bit better lately, to his credit, though. He continues to lead the league in missed dunks and ugly drives off pump fakes. He shot 2 for 10, as you mentioned. My theory on it was Kenny Atkinson, every time he went down the floor, started screaming at him, create variance.
And so he'd tell their worst three-point shooter to do that.
No, he's just like yelling it, and like AC just took it as like a battle cry, and he was like, all right, this is on me. I'm the best player on the team. He's a confident guy. He has that mentality like everyone in the league does. And he's like, I'm going to be the one who creates variance. And then he takes 10 threes and only makes two. And he creates variance the other way, where the Nets perform even worse than they actually are.
Okay, I like that theory. If we ever get a chance to interview Kenny Atkinson, I'm going to ask him about that specifically.
Here's the thing. Yeah,
the AC, he has no shame. He literally just shoots it whenever he gets the opportunity. And I feel like he doesn't even try to gauge how close the defender is to him, because there was one time where he made two threes in a row, and maybe he was 2 or 4 on the night. He gets the ball in a catch and shoot, the defender was literally right on top of him, and it was, I think it was like Rudy Gay or someone, and they just like stuck their arm out, and he just shot it directly into their hands. Like, mm-hmm. I don't understand how he conceivably thought that it was a good idea to shoot that, but I know more power to him. He's getting the minutes at this point because the Nets have absolutely no other option. Would I like to see them bring up someone from the D League? Sure. I don't really know who that would be. And I don't think anyone would be kind of a good replacement for AC because it's hard to get a competent stretch four, and he's certainly not that. But at the same time, he seems like a nice guy, a good guy to have in the locker room. I don't mind having him on the roster. Just seeing him play 20 minutes a night and being overextended is it can be tough to watch at times.
All right, so going forward, we are going to break down the rest of this Spurs game, talk about how the Nets got down by over 30 against the Pelicans, how they managed a brief comeback, Caris LeVert's continued excellent play, and why Josh is not bitter this week and doesn't have a grinds his gears. All that coming up next on the Locked On Nets podcast. Josh, to your point, I think that's kind of interesting that you mentioned that about AC. I want to just quickly throw this out there. Without AC's 2-for-10, the Nets shot really well from three. They were 10-for-22 outside of that, so that's pretty insane. But just to throw this out there, that was kind of my big takeaway watching the Nets against the Kings, and even watching someone like Zebo kind of consistently stretch the floor for the Kings. Like, how good would this Nets offense be if you threw like a really credible like 3-and-D center in there, like a true stretch five, like someone like Porzingis, or even if you want to go a step down from that, someone like Miles Turner. Like, I think if you put Porzingis on the roster, I know this is like kind of out there and unrelated to our general conversation, but I feel like the Nets would be like a top 4 or 5 team in the East immediately. Like, just like having an extra guy that could legitimately space the floor would just open everything up so much, and you combine that with a rim protector's body and ability, I think that would completely change his team. Obviously, those guys don't grow on trees, so maybe it's not in the foreseeable future, but who knows, if Jared Allen develops the right way, that could really change the outlook of this team going forward.
Yeah, I mean, they had Brook Lopez last year, who really developed into a credible stretch five, and I think that they're missing that this year, seeing as most of their fours and fives really can't shoot consistently from three-point range.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I just think it would be a game changer. And Allen hit a three against the Pelicans, so maybe
I'm not going to hold my breath on him.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Three-point shooter anytime.
All right, let's talk about the two guys who really stood out in that Spurs game. Jared Allen making his return to Texas. His parents were interviewed during the game. His dad, in particular, sounded exceptionally educated on the sport of basketball, as he should be, because he was apparently a stud at San Diego State. Yeah, and it was kind of funny. Then, like, they cut back to Ruco and Jim Spanarkle, and they were joking that Jared Allen's dad was going to step in for Spanarkle at halftime. So I thought that was pretty funny. Allen, 21 minutes, 6 of 11 from the field, 12 points, 9 rebounds, 5 of them on the offensive end. What do you make of that performance in his hometown going up against a pair of maybe future Hall of Famers in Pau Gasol and LaMarcus Aldridge?
Yeah, I mean, it's encouraging to see, of course. I think a lot of the damage he did was in garbage time, but he's a good offensive rebounder. His defensive rebounding needs a ton of work, but he's active. He puts himself in good position on the glass, and I think that was something I was worried about, his aggressiveness, especially on the offensive end. But I think he's seen that he's willing to kind of try to make plays and shoot, and obviously he's still going to be a little tentative out there, and that's fine because he's a 19-year-old rookie. But it's encouraging to see him put up good numbers, but I think his game against the Pelicans was absolutely horrible, and that's to be expected going up against Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins. But it is nice to see him put up good numbers, even if it's in garbage time, because there are a lot of rookies right now that definitely struggle with any playing time they have, whether it's in competitive game action or if it's in garbage time at the end.
Yeah, he did have one really nice rejection of Anthony Davis in that Pelicans game, but you could just tell he was totally outmatched on the offensive end going against those two. Like, he just doesn't really have the bulk to compete yet, and he's used to, like, his whole life he's probably been like longer, more athletic than every other guy he's gone up against, and then he kind of met his better half in Anthony Davis, so that was kind of a wake-up call for him, I think.
Caris, like the Spider-Man meme where they're both pointing at each other.
Yeah, that was it, except I think Anthony Davis's guy was maybe like cracking a smile more so than pointing in frustration. Caris LeVert against the Spurs, 28 minutes, 8 of 11 from the field, I'm just like stunned by how efficient he's been, and he's still like, he's obviously getting to the rim a lot more than he was early in the season, but he's still like kind of subsisting on like a pretty solid diet of threes and like pull up twos. But he just makes shots every single game now. Like, can you believe how consistent he is at 23 when he was just so bad to open the year?
Oh, it's incredible to watch what he's done. That just made me think of these Drake lyrics, 23 with a money tree. yeah, LeVert's been incredible. His three-point shots looked a lot more – he looked so much more comfortable with it. I think we were talking the whole offseason, summer league, preseason, early this year, about how he always rushes his jumper and his form. It should be good. He's a good touch, but he just keeps rushing it, and it seems like something clicked the last few weeks where he just stopped rushing it. And, you know, the shot is going in, and he's not – he's done a great job, I think, of mixing up his what he's going to drive to pass, when he's driving to score, when he's going to pull up. He's a really talented offensive player. He's a lot to work on with his turnovers. I think that's where he gets himself into trouble, where he's dribbling under the basket and jumps up and then just doesn't have anywhere to throw the ball, and he can make some lazy passes in the half court. But he has a future in this league as a secondary ball handler. He's up to 35% from three, and it's great to see this improvement because I was skeptical that he was going to get there this season, but he's been tremendous.
Yeah, you might think this is over the top, but I know I was talking about last podcast, and like the Pacers game like really convinced me he's on this trajectory. Like, I really do see him becoming like an Otto Porter, Chris Middleton level contributor in this league, and that's like the type of guy who's like now getting a max contract or close to it, and like obviously he's like on the lower end of guys you want to give that to, and obviously that's projecting ahead, but I don't know, to me he just seems like he's on that line. Like, obviously that's complicated a little bit by the fact that he is a little bit older for a second year guy at 23. I think if he's not 24, he's turning 24 pretty soon. But, Josh, you were the one who I think made this point to me this summer when I was arguing the merits of someone like Andrew Wiggins over Jimmy Butler. Like, it's not always how old you are, it's how long in the league you are. So it's gonna be interesting projecting how he ends up as a player and how much of a ceiling he really has left to reach.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough to say. I think that I don't know if he's ever going to be at the Middleton level defensively. I think he gets lost off ball a lot, and I think Middleton's a really underrated player. But just the guys you compare him to, I think he's a lot more – he has the ability to play point guard that those guys don't, and he might not ever be the catch-and-shoot guy that they are, but I think he's going to add more offensive value because of his ability to initiate the offense and find cutters.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily comparing them as players. I just meant like in terms of overall
that
impact.
Level, okay.
Yeah, I think it's feasible. All right, quick final notes on this one. There was the Spurs' 15th straight regular season win over the Brooklyn Nets. I think the last time the Nets beat them might have been in the 2003 finals or 2002 finals. I don't quite remember. The Nets fell to 4-41 all time in San Antonio, so that's not great. And then I wanted to give a shout out to the old vets. Pau Gasol's like almost 40, and he had 15-12-5 and has been consistently really, really good this year. Tony Parker, who I truly thought was going to retire after that like traumatic leg injury last season, is back, and at least against the Nets, looking pretty good. 14 points, 4 rebounds. Manu didn't have he had a pretty good game. 11 points in 21 minutes, 3 assists, 2 rebounds, and 1 vicious putback dunk. I don't know about you, Josh, but I've never really made any bones about it. I'm a lifelong fan of this Spurs team, and to see those guys that were amazing when we were in elementary school still kicking is pretty cool.
No, yeah, I think that, like, I don't know. The San Antonio team is crazy, like, that they're still around. I remember one of my first basketball memories is Jason Kidd was a free agent. Everyone was saying he was going to go to San Antonio, but I guess eventually they decided that they had this young kid, Tony Parker, this real upstart, that they thought get to have a future at point guard for them. And it's crazy to see 15 years later that he's still in the league. But yeah, Parker and Ginobili look good. I think that the Spurs' depth is unparalleled, and Pop can really make nobody into a decent rotation player. So it's great to see when you have, I guess they have four future Hall of Famers on the roster right now. But, yeah, they're a talented team. I think that the Nets, whatever it is, they just never seem to get over the hump there. Sometimes they play close for a quarter or two, but in the end, I think they have that block that they know they're not going to be able to get over the Spurs.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I think you're right on the four future Hall of Famers, and you could argue their best player, LaMarcus Aldridge, at least so far this season. Obviously, Kawhi's the best guy going forward. Isn't even a part of that group, so that's pretty stunning. All right, we're gonna get into that Pelicans game briefly, but first I wanted to tell you about my bookie. Bowl season is here, and it's time to get in on the action with my bookie. Are you sick and tired of getting the runaround when you ask for a payout? All you have to do is sign up at mybookie.ag today and get paid fast when you win. MyBookie is your hookup for all your betting needs, and you can even deposit Bitcoin. I know that's exciting to Josh and all those in the financial sector. All right, so here's why it's really appealing to you, the listener. You join now, and MyBookie will match your deposit up to a 50% bonus. All you have to do is use promo code LONETS, that's Locked On Nets, LONETS, to activate the offer. Visit mybookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. If you're going to bet, take my word for it, the only place to do it is at MyBookie. All right, Josh, let's talk Pellies. So the Nets were down by as much as 33 points in this game. Rajon Rondo had 25 assists, which I think was one of the 10 highest marks or so in NBA history. I even remember, like, before this game, one of the Sleep Institute people, and, like, of course, Todd Havistrow, like, this tweet, tweeted out that this was going to be a schedule loss for the Nets, and it seems like those are always right. And, like, by the beginning of the second half, it seemed like that was definitely the case. I was impressed by that 17-0 run the Nets had, but to me, they just didn't really have much of a chance in this game going up against Davis and Cousins, two guys, not one, who are just really unguardable for them.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, like, I saw people saying, oh, schedule loss. Like, if you're down by 30, it's more to it than just a schedule loss.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, but obviously this is a terrible matchup for the Nets. They really just didn't have a chance in this one, especially given their effort level, which was absolutely atrocious in the first half. Like, no tenacity on defense. I thought Rondae Hollis-Jefferson did a pretty good job, actually, in terms of gang rebounding and made a couple of nice deflections on – he was guarding Cousins primarily in the first half. Getting some deflections on him in the post. But as a team, there just wasn't enough energy there to maintain any sort of competitive edge, especially going up against a team that is a bad matchup with those two bruisers inside.
Yeah, and it's one thing when those guys are going off, but then the Nets started trying to compensate for it and were, like, pretty aggressively, like, doubling down low, helping out. Like, at times they throw three guys down there, but when you don't really have the size to match up, it's almost not going to matter. And the Nets were almost better in the second half when they played Mozgov and Jared Allen together. So they were kind of forced to contort their lineup in such a way that it was, like, feasible that they could stay alive defensively, but then offensively they weren't going to get anything out of that group. And it got kind of close at the end just because the Michigan duo of Nick Stauskas, who went 7 of 10 from 3, though, I wrote down in my notes, like, I didn't even think he played that well because, like, all of it came in – or, like, the vast majority of it came in garbage time. And then Caris LeVert, same deal, who finished with 22, 7 of 6, 8 of 15 from the field. Those guys made it kind of pliable. But, like, again, you have those two bigs going off, Davis and Cousins combining 21 of 38 from the floor, 60 points, 25 rebounds between the two of them. And then you have the Pelicans as a team shooting 17 of 33 from three on top of it. You're just not going to win that game.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, the Nets were just getting blown by in the perimeter by, like, Etuan Moore and Darius Miller and all these guys, which is, I don't understand how that happens. And then second of all, have you noticed that the Nets, a lot of the times when opposing player gets the ball in the post, they'll just double off him. They'll double off him, but they'll double the first pass, so, like, basically the pass that he can see directly in his line of vision. So he can easily make that pass back to an open three-point shooter. And you're supposed to double where the rotation can get there in time. So it's going to be, if he passes back to the perimeter and they swing the ball, you'll have time to help. But they just double off the first pass that any post player would look to.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. And at times it feels like as modern as the Nets are on offense, they're kind of equally, like, unsophisticated on defense. And I don't really know how much of that I'd pin on the coaching staff, because inherently, and this has been proven out time and time again, in the NBA, it's extremely difficult to construct a really strong defense with mostly young guys, which makes, I think, what Brad Stevens is doing in Boston, like, all the more incredible, that they're playing three wings that are all under 21 years old, and somehow they have the best defense in basketball. But yeah, it's really, really tough to build a defense with guys this young. So I don't really want to pin it on Atkinson, but maybe that's something to look at in the future. And like, I'm sure there's someone on the staff currently filling this role, but like, maybe down the road they bring in like a more experienced defensive coordinator type, like Steve Kerr did with Ron Adams, and I forgot the name of the guy with the Rockets, but Mike D'Antoni has a guy who only coaches defense. Like something like that maybe could happen. I'm not quite sure. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Atkinson is willing to adjust. I think last year at the start, the Nets were playing a very aggressive defensive style where they're blitzing the pick and roll, and the big men were coming out high to hedge. And I think he kind of realized that when your centers are Brook Lopez and Justin Hamilton, that's not a viable strategy.
Yeah.
I don't know. The whole thing about the defensive coordinator in the NBA is so like weird to me because that's such an NFL thing.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I feel like the coach should be able to kind of implement his general strategy on both offense and defense. While a lot of times in the NFL, like, one coordinator would have autonomy over an entire side of the ball. But I don't know. I think it's something to keep track of, but it's not something that needs to be dealt with imminently. And kind of once they are able to field a more competitive team in a year or two, then we'll kind of reevaluate how Atkinson's defensive philosophy has altered in that time. You mentioned Stauskas. His first half I thought was terrible, but he did obviously made his numbers look pretty at the end, just draining threes. I haven't been impressed with the guy besides the three-point shot. I think his handle is much worse than I expected. Kind of a sloppy passer. I don't know. What do you think of his game outside of his three-point shooting, which is, listen, if he keeps up that 57% from three, that's great, but I'm not going to count on it.
No, that's fair. I don't know. I thought the Pacers game was like a real step forward for him. Like that was the first. Like I know obviously like Toronto was his best game just because of how well he shot, but that Pacers game was like it felt like the first time like he figured out how to kind of seamlessly fit into the offense and really excel, like just by not jacking up every single three he gets and just making smart passes and like getting shots within the flow of things. And then this game I thought was kind of a step backwards in terms of that, just because him and Joe Harris, who've developed like a pretty good chemistry, but it just seems like all they're doing is like driving like 5 feet in and then kicking out to the other guy, and then the other guy's taking a three with someone rushing out on them. And particularly with Harris's shooting having really fallen off over the last few weeks, like I don't know how sustainable that is, and it looked really, really bad against the Pelicans. So it pains me to say it because like I've said it a couple times on this podcast, like I really am a big fan of Stauskas' game from college, but I don't think he's been the cleanest fit in the world so far. And I think maybe they'd be better off with reducing his role a little bit once D'Angelo Russell comes back. And like, I don't know if there is a spot for him in the rotation when that happens, but I'm torn on it because if he does keep shooting well, like I think that, I mean, shooting is just such a big deal in the league. And if you have a guy shooting like that, he should be out on the floor regardless of what the other deficiencies are. So it's kind of a yin and a yang, and you don't know if he's going to bring that every night, but I don't know. So I'm clearly conflicted on him.
Yeah, wow, we're really getting deep into your feelings on Stauskas.
I know.
No, I think that, yeah, as you mentioned, like if he can keep shooting at, let's say, even he shoots the three at a 45% clip, then he needs to be out there. But if he's at like 38% and he's not offering anything else, then I would kind of be inclined to reduce his role. But also that depends if Joe Harris gets traded and how soon D'Lo comes back. There's so many different factors, and the Nets don't tell us anything, so we really don't know a lot. There's a lot of it's very cloudy on what the situation is and how it can be resolved. But I think that Stauskas was an interesting flyer to take, and I think that I have been impressed. He's a fun player to watch, but I don't know how translatable his skills are into being actually a successful NBA player.
Yeah, we were told in exchange for Locked On Nets continued coverage, we'd have a full-time 24/7 direct line to Sean Marks, and I think he might have disconnected it after repeated calls at 2 in the morning where I just repeatedly screamed, Stauskas!
I think you screamed, you up.
Yeah, you up, question mark? Yeah, that didn't work out. All right, a few, that's essentially like all the basketball thoughts I had on this game. That 17-0 run was pretty awesome, but it came entirely against the Pelicans backups, and they threw Boogie and AD back in. And this
do you want to talk about Damari Carroll a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you go ahead. I don't have a ton of thoughts on his game. He was just quiet.
Yeah, I think he's been He was very bad against the Spurs. I thought he was 1 of 10 from the field. I think he's kind of been overexposed a little bit. He's someone that, if he's open from three, take it. If he has an advantage on either he's going up against a slower player or he's going up against a player he can kind of bully in the post, that's a good matchup for him. But if he's going up against a like-sized player and he's dribbling a lot and it's not going anywhere, he needs to understand to keep the offense moving. And I think that's a problem that we've seen from a lot lately.
No, I agree with you. And I think that is kind of emblematic of a lot of the issues this team had, not less so against the Spurs. And I probably should have mentioned this before, but like Greg Popovich, it could have just been him being generous to Sean Marks, like a guy he clearly loves. But he was super complimentary about the Nets and like just like the way they fought, like the way their offense ran, the way Kenny Atkinson coached the team. And Popovich is a guy who's clearly like not afraid to be blunt in any situation. So that was kind of cool to hear. Anyways, that was totally off topic. I want to say against the Pelicans, to me, it was like kind of a total regression back to the Kings game. And maybe you could just correlate this with the team being tired. But again, it was just another example of them not playing with enough verve. Like the guys like not attacking early. And like Spinarkle like made like a big point out of this during the 17-0 run. Like the reason things started to get going was because LeVert started attacking off the dribble. And guys, instead of just looking to pass it around and then take a contested three, their goal was to attack the basket. And if threes came within the flow of that, then it tended to work out more often than not. So I feel like that's an attitude the Nets have to bring quarter to quarter to quarter. And it's tough to do because like these other teams just with more talent don't really have to expel that same type of energy. But frankly, it's the only way the Nets can compete. So I know I had that rant at the beginning of the podcast, but I thought it was worth reiterating again that that's just the way the Nets have to play to win, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that they kind of get the way they play their system, it leads to a lot of threes. And then they kind of think, oh, that means we have to take a lot of threes. And then they're just jacking it up at the beginning of the shot clock and getting away from that ball movement and player movement that can be successful for them. So it's kind of a curse when they just see like the amount of threes they take, the raw total of that. And it's not about the amount they take, it's about the process and how they get there. So they need to start trusting the process. And it's not just going to be threes there. It's going to be layups, going to be open mid-range shots. So I think they need to start getting back to those fundamentals. I'm not sure how easy it is to do that in the middle of the season, but if possible, that would be nice, so I'm not stressing out as much as a fan.
Yeah, it remains interesting. The Nets, much like last year, and like this was kind of a different story early in the season when they were hitting them really well. They are second in the league in three-pointers attempted, and they are tied for 23rd in three-point percentage. And again, that's not necessarily a bad thing because the way the math works out, if you take enough threes, even if you're not hitting them at that high of a clip, that tends to be more efficient than you're going to be scoring on twos, particularly when you don't have a lot of talented individual scorers like the Nets do. So it's not like a commentary on their system saying it's bad. It's just to point out that like they're not quite as effective as like you might think they are taking that shot. And when they fall into a lull, that's why it gets really, really bad because they don't have a fallback option. All right, just a couple of final observations on this one. Two in particular. Quincy Acey, I think for the first time the entire season, like you know how recently like guys just like fly at him on closeouts because they know once Acey pump fakes, it's essentially already a turnover for the Nets. Like nothing that happens after that is going to end well. And for the first time I can remember this year, he had a pump fake in this game. Cousins went flying by him, and AC actually had a nice drive through the lane for a layup. So I wanted to give him a shout out because that's the first time.
That was such a circus shot. He can't be rewarded for that.
Well, no, come on. He deserves it. He's had so many traumatic moments on those plays.
I've had a lot of traumatic moments watching him.
All right, so you should be rewarded too, Josh. We're going to get you a free ticket or something. Anyways, there was that. And then far and away the funniest moment in the game, and like if you're a Pelicans fan, the whole game might have been funny. But there was like a Jay-Z song playing and they cut to like a group of like five kids in Nets jerseys like at the game. And one of them, there was like this like just like awkward little kid that actually like reminded me a lot of a young me, kind of bobbing along to the music. Like there was a clear like enthusiasm for hip hop, but just the execution wasn't there. But like Iron Eagle kind of like fluffed it up a little bit and just like he just kind of muttered under his breath, "Oh my God, I've never seen someone so natural before." And it was just like the funniest like little side comment I've ever, like I was laughing for like 4 or 5 minutes and it was really good.
That's why I am the best in the biz.
Now it's just like so, like the just that he comes up with that stuff in like the moment is brilliant. Anyways, yeah, that's pretty much all I had on the games. Josh, you don't have a grind your gears this week. Why is that? Why are you so abnormally content with life?
Yeah, it's the holiday season. I'm enjoying life, and it's great. I've been seeing you a lot lately, been hanging out. Disappointed by Star Wars, that can be a grind my gears. But I don't know. I've been working from home a lot this week, and which is a very nice surprise. And you are seem kind of shocked every day when I tell you I don't have to go into the office.
No, it's very frustrating because that almost never happens to me. Well, actually, I told you my boss sent me an email this week saying I didn't have to go in, and I saw it when I was already at work, and I biked through like -5 degree wind chill to get there, and I felt like I wanted to reward my accomplishment, so I ended up hanging out until 1 o'clock. Anyways, nobody wants to hear about this. For Josh, I'm Gavin. We'll likely be back this weekend to recap that Miami Heat game. If you didn't get a chance to check it out, please tune in to part one, part two. I went solo on the Pacers, Kings, and Wizards game. And I thought that was really kind of a pivotal stretch for this team. The Kings game, I thought was, now you could argue the Pelicans game was, but I thought at the time the Kings game was the worst game they played all year. The Wizards was the best they've played all year. And then the Pacers was the best game they've played in all year, just in terms of the quality of the back and forth. So please tune in to both of those. For Josh, I'm Gavin once again. Keep it with Locked On Nets at Locked On Nets on Twitter. Peace out.